This is a work of, in some ways, speculative or maybe creative theology. I'm trying out some ideas, and I want to hear back, right? So am I on the right track? I'm trying to extend Wesley. Is this a faithful extension or not? That's my question for you. So please listen and let me know what you think. So this is a social holiness, the problem of dementia for the doctrine of Christian perfection. In 2009, my father, who you can see here, that's my wife and I with my dad, my father suffered a massive stroke. And this was at the relatively young age of 72. You know, once upon a time, I thought that was older. I don't think that anymore. It seems really young. While initially he made a wonderful recovery from this catastrophic event, a slow decline set in with noticeably increased cognitive disabilities by 2012. Not long into this process, he was diagnosed with dementia, and eventually this diagnosis was clarified as dementia with Lewy bodies. This form of dementia includes a buildup of plaque in the brain that mimics the effects of Parkinson's disease. Many of the elements that you would expect to manifest with this condition surfaced. General confusion, loss of memory, sometimes seeing or experiencing things that were not present, etc. Slowly he lost the ability to take care of his personal hygiene needs, and very suddenly in December of 2015 lost the ability to walk. And this necessitated his placement in a long-term nursing home. Prior to this, my dad had exhibited a strong, strong feeling of displacement. He didn't find his current home familiar anymore and constantly sought to leave to go home. Sometimes you just go wandering out of the home as well. It was scary at times. This behavior intensified in the nursing home. When still mobile in his wheelchair, he spent a large part of each day wandering through the home. His ability to fully relate to others became limited because of his confused speech. And now, just a few years later, he actually spends most of his time sleeping and is no longer mobile. My mother visits with him every day. She actually pays for someone to go on days she can't go. She's a saint. And my brother and I visit at every opportunity. As with most dementia patients, his general confusion is broken by remarkable moments of lucidity. However, these are very, very few and far between. Similar to the experience of others in the room, I'm sure there are other significant people in my life that have developed this condition. My doctoral supervisor has the exact same diagnosis as my dad, and actually one of my colleagues at Roberts had to retire just a couple of years ago because in his 50s because of early onset dementia. So this is here, right? This is real, and this is part of our continual experience. So my father's condition, these other stories, they raise so many theological questions for me. How do we relate to God when we no longer remember who we are? When I cannot understand what is going around me, and even when I fail to understand myself. Well, I have been taught in my theological training to recognize that some of the influence of dualistic, that is mind-body, and individualistic, atomistic thinking on theological formulation, the issue of dementia puts these issues in stark relief. If our sense of personhood is intimately connected to our ability to think, as it is in the Cartesian philosophical anthropology, then dementia is a particularly nefarious condition because this condition limits our ability to think. And thus, with respect to Cartesian dualism, it entails a loss of personhood. And even if we don't accept this Cartesian dualism, dementia does not leave us any better off with the volitional and affective aspects of the person. All of them are ravaged by this condition. And so we're left with all kinds of questions regarding the function of basic theological concepts and practices. Is someone with advanced dementia able to respond to prevenient grace, just to accept justifying faith, and live a life of progressive sanctification? My impulse, honestly, is to say yes, but I don't know if it's just because I feel so connected to this now that I just want to say, of course, yes. And so I set for myself the challenge of saying, well, let's take the hardest one. Let's take perfection and see if we can understand what perfection might mean in the context of dementia. And if we can make sense of it in some way, and honestly, you know, clearly this isn't something that Wesley talked about, but if we can faithfully extend Wesley here, then I mean, I want to answer yes. So this is my attempt, right? So here's my thesis. Here's my thesis. Dementia does not exclude any Christian from all aspects of salvation and sanctification. However, uh, it, it does mean that the experience of salvation and sanctification will be different for those with dementia. The experience of dementia means that community becomes crucial for the fulfillment of sanctification. And in fact, I would probably say that regardless of dementia or not. And so rather than considering entire sanctification as a state of perfection, we need to consider the impact of perfecting community. And that's my category I'm going to develop in the context of this paper, perfecting community. I'll show you the steps I take to get there. So this paper will proceed by briefly defining first Christian perfection and then dementia. Then after arguing that our concept of personhood challenges our understanding of dementia, we will consider how new models for Christian perfection, how new models can expand our understanding of personhood. Finally, I will argue that we should adopt a new symbol of Christian perfection, namely perfecting community, that will make possible the potential of Christian perfection even for those with advanced dementia. So first, perfection. And we've heard about this in numerous papers today, so I really don't intend to spend long on this at all. Just a couple of points. As a general summary, Christian perfection can be defined as a state of being where love rules in the heart such that the heart is entirely devoted to God. It is both a possibility and an expectation for Wesleyans that mature Christians will be perfected in love in this lifetime. This is nothing less than a state of holiness, which is, of course, why Christian perfection is also referred to as entire sanctification. Wesley refers to it this way. He defines it in this sense: the loving God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. This implies that no wrong temper, none contrary to love, remains in the soul, and that all the thoughts, words, and actions are governed by pure love. As we've heard multiple times today, there is a dynamic and progressive sense to Wesley's ideas, such that I believe it's better to speak of perfecting love rather than perfect love, to speak of teleosis rather than perfectus, right? This dynamic sense of development. In other words, to think of this as a state of becoming, not necessarily a state of being, in that dynamic sense. And in fact, you know, perfection as a state of being is problematic because it distorts the dynamic nature of our relationships and implies a kind of unequivocal knowledge or unambiguous capacity to respond to God. Yet, I mean, those who are sanctified in this way, there will be a qualitative difference that is expected for those who respond to God with this kind of yes. This difference grounds a new orientation that is directed properly towards God and provides the direction for growth and holiness. In light of this teleological interpretation, Mark Mann argues that we are perfect in the sense of being properly oriented toward our absolute goal in God, such that our lives are thereafter formed and shaped by this orientation. The centrality of this doctrine to Methodist theology is widely recognized. Randy Maddox claims that Wesley believed God raised up Methodism specifically to teach this doctrine. The language of perfection always caused some confusion in the reception of this idea. All of us are deeply in tune, of course, with our own imperfections, so that it almost seems arrogant to claim perfection, as a state of being. When disputes arose over this question of the nature of perfection in relation to sin, Wesley was quick to point out that perfection did not mean perfection of natural capabilities like knowledge or freedom from natural limitations. In his plain account of Christian perfection, Wesley clearly states that the perfect are not free from infirmities, such as weakness or slowness of understanding, irregular quickness or heaviness of imagination. Such another kind are impropriety of language, ungracefulness of pronunciation, to which one might add 1,000 nameless defects, either in conversation or behavior. From such infirmities as these, none are perfectly freed till their spirits return to God. And when responding to questions about his understanding of Christian perfection, Wesley consistently declares that perfection in this sense does not mean anyone is free from infirmity, ignorance, or mistake. In other words, it is possible in Wesley's understanding to be perfect and still be infirm and ignorant and mistaken, even to still be in need of atonement for mistakes of judgment and practice, for omissions, shortcomings, and defects. So for Wesley, you can be perfect and still suffer the limitations of being human, right, in a profound sense. All of these comments at least open the door to talking about Christian perfection and dementia together. Dementia clearly is an infirmity. My question still remains, though, whether the disability that dementia creates is too great to allow for any deeper sanctification. So we'll move on to define dementia. When my father was diagnosed with dementia, we were given a document published by Group Health that included the following definition. Not this one, but a different one. Dementia is a disorder characterized by problems with memory and at least one other cognitive function: learning, reasoning, language, spatial ability, orientation, and handling complex tasks. Problems that are severe enough to interfere with the activities of daily living. This document is careful to distinguish dementia from memory loss and mild cognitive impairment that is consistent with aging. Thus, the normal elements of aging are distinguished from the more severe deficiencies that come with dementia. This definition corresponds to the standard definition that is given in the World Health Organization International Classification of Diseases, and this is that definition here, which is very helpful. Dementia is a syndrome due to disease of the brain, usually of a chronic or progressive nature, in which there is disturbance of multiple higher cortical functions, including memory, thinking, orientation, comprehension, calculation, learning capacity, language, and judgment. Consciousness is not clouded. The impairments of cognitive function are commonly accompanied and occasionally preceded by deterioration in emotional control, social behavior, or motivation. The syndrome occurs in Alzheimer's disease, in cerebrovascular disease, and in other conditions primarily or secondarily affecting the brain. This classification, which is designed for the sake of pathology, right, for defining, for determining who has this condition, understands dementia as a mental defect that primarily affects cognition. When your cognitive abilities are significantly reduced and there is no other apparent reason for the disability, then you can be classed as having dementia. This definition also indicates that this cognitive malfunction will lead to other issues, emotional and social, that creates a web of problems. While these definitions are helpful and play an important role in giving structure and parameters for the helping professions, they are also significant for what they exclude. In his excellent book on this subject, Dementia, Living in the Memories of God, John Swinton properly notes that definitions are not value neutral, they're often value forming. These definitions should cause us to ask questions about the assumptions that ground them and the implications that flow from them. In the first place, Swinton points out that definitions like these are by design and necessity universal and emphasize the impact on typical patients. Something is lost and something is gained in this approach. What is gained is a language that enables medical professionals to offer precise diagnoses in order to construct appropriate treatment plans. Through this process, the condition is named and a plan can be formed to deal with it. Medically and culturally, this allows us to conceive of dementia as a brain condition with certain behavioral outcomes. What is lost in this definition is the social nature of the disease, insofar as one's experience of dementia, of isolation, of loneliness, of malignant social positioning, both create and exacerbate the condition. Most devastatingly, though, is the idea that dementia is solely a neurological defect. Dementia itself, the word itself, means deprived of mind. We quickly come to the conclusion that having dementia means losing one's mind. And surely this is the great fear we experience in the face of this condition. I will cease to be me. In the end, this approach, this pathological neurological approach, assumes that the most important aspects of human experience are neurological and that dementia is primarily a neurological defect. This blinds us to the social realities and implications of the experience of dementia. This idea, which most of us find utterly terrifying, raises so many questions. Primarily, who am I if I can no longer remember, understand myself, and those closest to me? Immediately behind these questions of classification are models of what it means to be human. And I have a chart here where I'm going to sort of follow through this chart here that I've created. In the modern dualistic Cartesian perspective, we are primarily thinking things, res cogitans, as he names it. We're thinking things that bear some mysterious relation to that which is extended through space. John Locke likewise claims that a human being is a thinking, intelligent being that has reason and reflection and can consider itself as a self, the same thinking thing in different times and places, which it does only by that consciousness which is inseparable from thinking and as it seems to me to be essential to it. This particular kind of anthropological dualism emerges in the modern era with Cartesian philosophy. If we are truly res cogitans, thinking things, if this defines what we mean by personhood, then it is clear that those who are intellectually deficient are actually less than persons. And you know, and it is this exact problem out of modern philosophy, I think, that creates all of our issues with beginning of life and end of life, you know, matters, right? Where we imagine that there are humans that we can say are not persons, right? Which is bizarre, but it comes from here. I believe it comes from here. I think I'll move. I have a great example from Peter Singer. I don't know if you know who Peter Singer is. He's a utilitarian philosopher who really, you know, believes that you can clearly define some humans as not persons. And so he's all for, you know, radical forms of euthanasia, right? Until I just have this, you know, this nice story, and until his mother got sick at the end of life and he paid all this money to keep her alive, in the interview he said, "I don't have any clue why I'm doing it. It's a waste of money, but I can't seem to let her go." You know, I mean, this kind of, you know, cognitive dissonance between his philosophical ideas and his life, which I think has to happen out of this perspective. Clearly, this definition of personhood is limited. There are two distinct but related forms of reductionism at work here. First, Cartesian mind-body dualism reduces the person to merely a thinking thing. You know, that's primarily what you are. And secondly, atomistic individualism places the self rather than the community, the self including self-consciousness, at the center of human experience. It results in a disembodied and socially disconnected conception of the person. And seeing Christian doctrines through this lens creates distortion as well. For example, it makes belief a function of my cognitive understanding of God's nature rather than a relationship of trust. It reduces the importance of my embodiedness and teaches that there is, you know, that it is my soul, merely my soul, which is being prepared for an eternity with God. Moreover, sanctification becomes a radically individualistic concept in this idea of personhood. I am made holy through the work of the Spirit in me. Sanctification is not for the body, though the body may help the practice of holiness, or the community, although holiness serves the community, but sanctification is for myself and my relationship to God. And all of that I'm claiming is a distortion. The danger of this kind of reductionistic thinking, especially for spiritual formation, is that it manifests in what Martin Buber refers to as I-it relationships, treating other subjects as if they were objects. You are only real to me insofar as you are useful to me. I-thou relationships are the key to genuine personhood. I-thou relationships are grounded in real connection with the other for the sake of the other, treating other subjects as subjects in themselves. However, along with Buber, we must acknowledge that the primary I-thou relationship is always first and foremost with God. So rethinking perfection then, trying to rethink perfection. In his book, and I highly recommend this book to you, in his book Perfecting Grace, Mark H. Mann argues that the Wesleyan doctrine of perfection needs to be better reconciled with contemporary understanding of theological anthropology, which emphasizes the embodied nature of human beings and their social reality. This way of seeing human nature has been growing and is recognized by some as more consistent with the Hebrew worldview as opposed to the Greek worldview. To paraphrase Genesis 2:7, we are animated earth. Terra animata, as Augustine even himself says in City of God. In other words, to be human is to be embodied. At the same time, you cannot simply reduce humanity to its material nature, but it is not clear that we exist apart from our embodied nature. One profound implication of this way of thinking of human nature is that our spiritual development is very much dependent on our social relatedness. It is our life together in community that forms us into mature and virtuous people rather than some disembodied mystical process. That's what we do together. Mann further recognizes that our sense of self is complex and exists in dialectical tension between the social and psychological forces that shape human nature and our enduring sense of self. While human beings are dynamically shaped by their relationships and various aspects of their personal and social worlds, generally speaking, human beings are able to weave these experiences together into a unified sense of self, a transcendent individuality that gives integrity to the person. In defining human nature, Mann suggests four linked polarities. He says that human beings are united centers of multiple dimensions, the moral, the physical, the social. Human beings are fully individual and yet come to their fruition in relation. Human beings are fundamentally open and dynamic, but always within larger structures. And human beings are a profound combination of a given, embedded nature that also possess a genuine freedom. This way of conceptualizing human nature requires significant adjustment for understanding spiritual formation. And here's a quote from Mann. Do I have this? No, I don't have that yet. That one's coming later. So this is a quote from Mann. He says, "Indeed, so deeply are individuals embedded socially that it is highly problematic to consider holiness solely a matter of a person's individual relatedness to God and others. No doubt individual holiness is important, but it is only part of the picture. Not only are individuals shaped by their communities, institutions, cultures, and societies, but habits of sin and holiness can become embedded in the practices, systems, and structures of those same communities, institutions, cultures, and societies." Mann concludes that our ability to be spiritually formed will be somewhat dependent on our psychological and our social conditioning, right? It's this embeddedness that leads to this formative idea. So when it comes to the doctrine of Christian perfection, Mann proposes that we begin to use new symbols which can unpack this doctrine in relation to a more dynamic and social understanding of human nature. Thus, alongside the more traditional symbols of perfecting love and renewal of the Imago Dei, Mann suggests additional symbols which correspond to various aspects of human maturity. I think I have these here. Let's see. I have these here. I'm going to come back to that quote in a minute. So this is Mann's argument in his book, in the latter chapter of his book, that we need new symbols of what perfection actually looks like, and we can distinguish different stages of perfection according to life stages. It's a really powerful idea. So that, thinking about infancy, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, etc., we can think of perfecting hope for an infant. We can think of perfecting will for a child. Perfecting purpose, right? And competence for teenagers, for adolescents. Perfecting fidelity for adulthood. Perfecting care and perfecting wisdom for those later in life. And this is really embracing this idea that what Wesley must have meant is something dynamic and progressive. And so we can see this. We were talking about this a couple papers ago, I think, in a way. And I think this actually, Mann actually spins this out. So it's the last two that are particularly relevant for our purposes today. Perfecting care is an extension of perfecting love. While perfecting love already orients us towards others in a profound way, such that our sense of holiness corresponds to our service, perfecting care broadens the scope of our regard. Care is, this is a quote from Mann, care is inclusive of the orientation and scope of love, but also tends to be parental and to take into account the larger context, situation, and world of which individuals are a part. Thus, perfecting care is oriented towards the whole. This means institutions and systems as well as individuals. And then finally, perfecting wisdom is an extension of the symbol of caring. It is the wisdom in the face of death to affirm the value of one's own life, and more, to affirm the value of all life and creation itself. In general, I believe that Mann has helped us to understand how this doctrine might be lived out in a contemporary context. I've learned a great deal from his work, but I'm struck that at the end, holiness is still about me and about my relationships to others, despite his focus on the fundamental nature of our embeddedness and relatedness. If this is truly the case, then it means that holiness in this regard is impossible for people with dementia who no longer have this same sense of self. And maybe this is really the case, maybe I'm grasping, but I want to propose another symbol in addition to the symbols that Mann has proposed to extend this idea and to really extend, well beyond what Wesley intended. And this is a new symbol then, the idea of perfecting community. So this is where I had this quote from John. I'll just come back to that in a moment, but here's this quote from John Swinton. The important thing to see is that any diminution of the self is first and foremost a diminution of community. The self is an individual and a communal process, not an individual inner possession or state of mind. A person does not lose herself. Her community loses her. If this is so, then dementia is much more than a neurological disease which occurs within the brains of discrete individuals. Dementia is a communal and relational condition that involves, but cannot be defined, by neurological decline. If we take Wesley seriously, that perfection does not mean overcoming infirmity, it seems that the possibility of a form of perfection includes infirmity. Even dementia, right? If it is possible to conceive of perfecting community as a symbol of Christian perfection, then two elements will be necessary. First, the orientation of care will be from the community to the one with dementia. Thus, rather than perfecting the capacity to love, the capacity to love, this aspect of the doctrine will consider perfecting the capacity to receive love. Perfecting the capacity to receive love. Advanced dementia includes a profound reliance on others for all basic bodily and social needs. There can be grace in receiving at this stage of life. Secondly, perfecting community will necessarily include remembrance. When we have forgotten who we are and whose we are profoundly reliant on our community to remember for us. This begins with God. And the subtitle for Swinton's book on dementia is Living in the Memories of God. Once again, Swinton writes, "To suggest that God remembers persons with advanced dementia is not a palliative avoidance of the real truth that they have lost their identity. Neither is it an abandonment of these people by God in the present. Quite the opposite. It is a firm statement that God is with them, God is for them, and that God is acting with them and for them in the present as they move towards God's future." In a similar vein, Rosalie Hudson writes, "When the Spirit aids our remembrance, we are truly remembered. This signifies profound hope for those who are demented, who may now in Christ become re-mented, re-minded, remembered." Right? Think about that, remembered, part membered in the community again. Right? This is a form of holy grace that can dynamically shape someone with dementia. I have a little bit on process thought here, but I'm going to skip that. We must also rely on the community to remember for the one who cannot remember anymore. And strangely enough, this remembering isn't necessarily verbal, but it comes through bodily presence and through connectedness. When I'm with you and continue to relate to you as father, as teacher, as colleague, rather than the one who does not know who they are, I'm remembering and living what they have forgotten. Corporate memory of this type should come naturally to Christians. After all, the central sacrament and ritual is precisely this experience of corporate memory, right? This is my body that is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink in remembrance of me. Passover for our Jewish brothers and sisters is likewise a communal remembrance of God's liberation of his people from Egypt. Already well practiced in gathering together to practice remembrance, the community is called to share in the collective remembrance of what God has done in each other's lives. To tell the stories of shared experience and continue to practice the rituals like communion that provide a shared common experience. Collective memory is an essential aspect of this life together. Right? And so I'm suggesting that shared remembrance together can actually confer grace, can extend the symbol of perfection to reception. As I'm sure many of you know, dementia patients can show remarkable lucidity at surprising moments. Here is a story of one of those moments. My parents are transplants in their community and as such joined a church outside of their familiar denomination. which their denomination didn't have a church in their town. And while they have developed profound friendships in this church, it is safe to say they remain on the fringes of the central community. And while we have asked numerous times for the church to come and share communion with my dad, the elders have actually only come twice, and he's been there for like, it's really sad, he's been there like 4 years, and they've only come twice in that time to share communion with him, which I'm extremely disappointed about. But, you know, my dad, when you're with him, when you talk to him, if he's having a good day, he'll respond. But almost always it's mumbling or it's the wrong words. Like he'll be trying to say something, but he doesn't remember the right words anymore. So it'll be all confused. And I wasn't there. I wish I was there this day. My mom told me about it. When they were sharing together the holy meal, they also shared a time of communal prayer. And when the person leading the prayer paused at the end of communion and said, "Let us pray," it was to everybody's shock in the room. I started crying. My dad was the one that started to pray. You know, it was the shared ritual, the shared moment, right? And this is in time where he hadn't said coherent words for such a long time and was able to actually lead the prayer, right? It was a moment of profound grace. And that it was connected to communion, it's just that's not incidental. That's key, right? And so here, I mean, grace is... Grace was manifest through my father's community. My father's holiness in this moment was in receiving love and care that even allowed him a participatory element. So in this case, the relational moment spurred the receptivity to grace. My hope is, however, that even when that receptivity is not immediately evident, that God ministers through his spirit to those such as my dad in such a way that entire sanctification is still possible. My mom visits my dad every day and surrounds him as best she can in a community of loving grace. You know, Wesley's famous comment on the social nature of holiness seems to imply that holiness happens in community. What I'm suggesting is that in special circumstances like dementia, it in fact is the holiness of the community that confers holiness on the individual. And you know, and as I've thought more and more about this, I'm not even sure that it's so special. I'm not sure that isn't just how it's always supposed to work, that it's always that relatedness. It's always that relatedness, and that's what Wesley was trying to point us towards. And the holiness of the individual consists in receiving this grace, even if they do not know it. And insofar as this openness continues, recognizing that often it will not appear so, entire sanctification for those with dementia is a real possibility. It's not a guarantee. I'm not trying to say that everybody, you know, has this or anything like that. I mean, dementia can really, it can be horrible, right? And it can expose those deepest elements of yourself that you've hid. People's dementia can become incredibly violent. It can cut you open. But what I want to maintain is that it's still a possibility in these terms for this kind of perfecting love. So there you go.